Wednesday is This Week in Chicago History Day with Anna DeVlantis, and we start with an infamous killer in Chicago history. Good morning, Anna.
Good morning, Bob. No doubt. So 1896, this week, marked the final chapter, the end for notorious Chicago serial killer H.H. Holmes. His horrific crimes brought to life in the best-selling novel many people have read, Devil in the White City. H.H. Holmes was hanged for his crimes this week. Real name Herman Mudgett, who had opened up the hotel at 63rd and Wallace, right near the World's Fair, as the Chicago Fair was going on, and had offered lodging to people from all over the world. Problem was, visitors to his hotel had the habit of disappearing, particularly if they were women. These macabre stories of what happened inside that hotel just started circulating, and it took years to uncover what truly happened. We pulled a clip here, Bob, a local historian, Ray Johnson, explaining some of what happened inside the so-called murder castle on Chicago's South Side.
Originally, when he built it, it was only two floors. He added the third floor once it was put out that the World's Fair was going to come to Chicago. And, you know, he was about making money. It's not that he wanted to kill everyone that came there. The second floor had special rooms that were piped with natural gas so that once the person went to sleep, he could turn the gas on in the room until they were dead. And then he had kind of like a big dumbwaiter, but it was basically a chute that went from the second floor to the basement. I don't know if you've seen the play or the movie Sweeney Todd. That's where they got the idea for, you know, when the chair went back and the person was dropped down into the basement, that's kind of where they got that idea from. So he did have a chute that went from the second floor that was big enough to accommodate a human being to be stuffed into it and then dropped into the basement. Patrick Quinlan was known as the janitor of the building. He did teach him how to strip the skin and muscles and everything else from a body and then dry out the bones and articulate them so that you put it together, you know, like a full skeleton, and then you took it to the medical college and they would give you $200, no question ask, which was a lot of money at the time. So he would collect the insurance money, and why let a good body go to waste when you can get $200 for it? Now, what happened to the rest of the body? No one really knows.
I wonder if they're ever going to make that movie about it. They've been talking about it for years, haven't they?
Last I heard, Leonardo DiCaprio was attached to it. I mean, they've had so many different iterations of that. I don't know, Bob. We got to ask Dean about that, if that's ever going to happen. Such a good story, if you think about it. The other interesting thing listeners may want to check up on is the History Channel did a series of reports, I think about 10 years ago, with the great-great-grandson, Jeff Mudgett, who teamed up with a former CIA analyst. And it's their belief, and they produce some evidence, though it's still a theory, not proven, but they produce some evidence that that Herman Mudgett was actually also Jack the Ripper because of the crimes and the time that he was in London and that kind of thing. Some people refute that, saying that the crimes weren't exactly similar, but there is some evidence and certainly an interesting story if you're into that kind of thing, to go back and take a look, see what you think.
A lot of mystery still. A lot of talk around here about Google and the new version of the Thompson Center. Back in 1985, it was still on the drawing boards. Or is that when they started building it?
Well, that's when they commissioned it. They found the architect, renowned architect Bob Helmut Jahn, who studied under Mies van der Rohe, just really a celebrated architect. And they commissioned him 40 years ago to say, hey, go ahead and design this building. You know, we need to all of our offices to have departments within this one, you know, Chicago-based headquarters. There's places in Springfield, but we want it here. And so they gave him that task, and way before Google decided to try to redevelop the Thompson Center, this was the initial development. And, you know, I know a lot of people consider it an architectural masterpiece, and then there are a lot of people who say it's a complete eyesore, and why was that ever built? What an awful use of office space with that huge atrium in the middle. We pulled a clip from the architect himself, Helmut Jahn, explaining what he was tasked with designing the Thompson Center back in the day, what the state authorities asked him to do.
Governor Thompson that time was the first governor after 25 years of other governors trying to build a major signature building which represents the state of Illinois in downtown Chicago. And after we got awarded the job, we went to Springfield and had a meeting with the governor, and we had like seven schemes because we had to deal with what to do on a big block. because they wanted a high-rise building. But a high-rise building only was 35 stories tall, and there was a lot of empty land, and it was very underurban. And one day, we had to present three schemes. One tower, medium-rise tower, and the building which was ultimately built. And I had to not favor any scheme. I said, Helmut, you better not push him in one direction. He needs to decide.
Helmut Jahn. He sounded like Henry Kissinger.
Never, a little bit.
Never thought
you're
about
right.
That.
That's so true. Yeah, and you know, Google's now doing $300 million renovation, I guess you could say, that they just kicked off. They're trying to preserve some of it and bring the building into the 21st century. So we'll see what they do, Bob.
It's This Week in Chicago History. Anna, let's talk about a little Mother's Day history in Chicago.
You know, this is interesting, Bob. You go back to 1909, the first mention of Mother's Day being celebrated in the Chicago area. This is what happened. There was this woman named Sarah Worrell who talked about this new holiday in the Chicago Tribune. She gave a short interview about what they were doing in Virginia honoring mothers. And she kind of asked Chicago, should we celebrate it too? She said, why don't we all wear white carnations this upcoming Sunday, which is like 5 days away at this point, to honor mothers? And, you know, she really was a grassroots organizer before her day because she reached out to the religious community, to teachers and charity groups across the city. 5 days later, Sunday, May 9th, 1909, thousands of people wore white carnations across the city to honor mothers. And it's interesting because the following year it became a state holiday, and it wasn't until 1914, several years later, when President Woodrow Wilson declared Mother's Day a national holiday, the second Sunday in May. So
interesting. We can take credit for it here. I like that.
Yes. Well, yeah, we got Chicago. Yeah, credit there.
Now, let's go back to the last time we had cicadas invading.
221 years ago, Bob, this happened. What we're about to, or we're seeing, a cicada invasion of this magnitude when multiple broods are emerging from the ground at the exact same time, the 13-year brood and the 17-year brood, and they're both coming out, deciding to come together, and this is the year. I went back and combed through old newspaper articles during Chicago's cicada years, and it's interesting to see the perceptions of cicadas, how they've changed dramatically over the years. Now, we never loved them. I know that won't surprise you, Bob, but back 200 years ago, people actually thought that they were poisonous, like extremely dangerous, and stay away, and they were beating them away with sticks and things like that. Some thought that they were like a bad omen. There was a signal that war was near when you saw the cicadas. This was the belief back then. There's a fun story in 1990 with Ricardo Muti, the CSO conductor, performing at Ravinia at a summer concert with all these cicadas crawling on his back. It's like, oh, the Chicago Tribune talked about that. It's kind of interesting when the shift happened, because when we realized they're completely harmless and just a nuisance, there was this great news article we picked, or news clip, here from the 1990 invasion, when they were having fun with it, a cicada eating contest, and trying to figure out what to do with all the cicadas.
Chicago is literally buggy.
He's reached the halfway mark.
Witness these stalwart cicada swallowers, brave bug biters, plucky pest packers.
The wings stick a little in your throat, but they're good.
They gave away $100 to the guy who could eat the most cicadas. The battered covered ones are worth 1 point, live ones two, and snatching one crawling on your shirt is a 3-point shot. How do you normally eat cicadas, by the way?
I normally don't eat them.
That may be the most intelligent thing anyone has said yet.
Get ready for all those stories again. Here they come. Yeah. And finally, a little history of a drink that I remember, the Green River. Yeah. I mean, it's still around, but I don't know if it's the same, is it?
Hard to find, really hard to find. Did you like Green River, Bob? Was it a favorite back in the day?
Well, you know what? They used to have these machines on the L stations, on the platforms, and you could get a Green River soda, and I always did.
Yeah, it's interesting because such a nostalgic attachment to this, a Chicago favorite for generations. Actually, an Iowa man's recipe sold it to the Schoenhofen Edelweiss Brewing Company in Chicago, which made it famous and just became a huge hit at soda fountains across the city. During Prohibition, it became their number one selling drink because they couldn't sell their beer, and then became second only to sales in Coca-Cola nationwide back in the day. But it's changed hands several times, fell out of favor a little bit. Then that nostalgia factor brought it back. It's had a resurgence. The Sprecher Brewing Company now owns it, and they say a third of their annual sales of Green River Soft drinks occur on and around St. Patrick's Day. So go figure. Still a hit. At least one time a year.
Wow. Chicago history from 1919. The Green River Lime Pop, as we say. Thank you, Anna.
Neon talk to you. Color, too.
Yeah, it's just like the relish on your hot dog. Yeah. Have a good day.
Bye, Bob.